9:62. And believe it or not, we're going to go with Jim Marquis, Susan Landry, and Raymond Dawson. And as they're coming up, I want to be done by 2:15. And so right around 2 o'clock, it would be nice to get both sides up at the panel for rebuttal if that is needed. So I just, after the main presentations of both. So,
Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I'm Jim Marquis, representing the American Chemistry Council. I have with me Ray Dawson and Susan Landry, who are members of the American Chemistry Council and also representing the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum. I'm not going to testify other than to just introduce them because I know you're short on time and I want you to hear from them. They've come a very long way to testify.
Louisiana, as I understand. Okay.
Okay. It looks like the PowerPoint presentation is coming up. I don't know if we can do something to...
And then please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Landry. I'm from Albemarle Corporation. I come today in opposition to Senate Bill 962. 962 goes further than any other piece of U.S. legislation, and it's calling for the ban on decabromodioxinol ether, or DECA-BDE, as I'll refer to it. The presentation, we'll break it into two. Ray will give the second half, and I'll give the first half. You might wonder, why is DECA-BDE used? It's used to improve the fire safety of plastics. In addition to saving lives, you have economic losses reduced, injuries are reduced, and there's a reduction in immediate local pollution that is a result of the fire. If you have less fires, you have less of this pollution. There are increased fire risk in our home and our offices in our world today because of more consumer products, more plastic in consumer products, increased power, miniaturization, widespread use of the standby function. It seems like everything in my house goes into standby. It never goes off. So if you look at the fire statistics from 2003, the fire departments in the U.S. responded to over 1.5 billion fires. Those fires killed approximately 4,000 civilians. So even with our best efforts for fire safety, with fire safety built into many consumer goods, we still have an incredible amount of fires. And many of those fires occur in residential properties. If you look at these two particular sets of pictures. The top one is from a European TV. Historically, European TVs have not been flame retarded. The plastic casing or housing on the TV is made from a plastic with no flame retardancy. Recently, that is changing because of fire safety. The TV on the bottom is an American TV. Historically, American TVs have had a high level of fire safety built in. The flame retardant, particularly DECA-BDE, is incorporated and encapsulated in the plastic housing. So if you look at the top set of slides, a fuel pill or very low-level ignition source is placed in contact with the TV. That would be similar to a candle, which many candles are placed near TV or other electronics. And you see from that top set of slides that in approximately 8 minutes, you have a flashover of the room. Incredible amount of fire smoke. The bottom set of pictures, you can see the fuel pill is placed in contact with the TV. The TV never ignites. The fuel pill goes out in approximately 1 minute and 45 seconds. You have, this is a unupholstered sofa. In the U.S., upholstered furniture is only mandated in California and in certain commercial properties, such as in this building. I'm sure a lot of the furnishings are flame retarded. And in the U.K., so elsewhere in the world, there's really not standards in place. This particular couch, you see, is in contact with a candle, but it could be similar to a child playing with matches. And you see, in less than 5 minutes, the room flashes over. Consumer electronics and consumer goods contain DECA? You see, the plastic housings from TVs and other electrical equipment can contain DECA. Electrical connectors, and those could be in the televisions, in your buildings, in your autos. Wire and cable coatings, the coverings on wire and cable, again, in autos, your home, or in buildings. textile back coatings. This chair, for instance, the textile may well have a back coating that contains DECA. Again, parts in automobiles, airplanes, space shuttles, there are many, many different things that contain DECA. One particular study that was done estimated approximately 190 lives are saved each year from the use of DECA in television housings. And again, many lives have been spared over the years as a direct result of the use of DECA. One of the unintended consequences which should be worried about is that a potential ban on DECA could reduce fire safety standards. Many of these fire safety standards, such as in TVs, are voluntary. They're not mandated. So the TV backs do not have a mandatory flame retardant standard. So that is something that could be a consequence of such a prohibition. And you may hear today that there are alternatives to DECA. Let me just first state that DECA is the most tested flame retardant that is available. My colleague will go into more detail on all this testing. The fact is that alternatives have not been tested to anywhere near the extent of human health and environmental testing and characterized to the extent that DECA has. And true, you may hear that some electrical equipment manufacturers have chosen to move from DECA to alternative flame retardants, but that's basically on, it's due primarily and solely to market pressure. And you hear Intel doesn't use DECA. Intel never used DECA for electrical connectors. That's not the flame retardant that's used there. So if they prohibited it, they never used it. So, in moving from DECA to alternative flame retardants, again, there needs to be a worry that you have the possibility of unintended consequences due to the human health and environmental unknowns that surround these alternative materials. My company, Albemarle Corporation, in addition to making brominated flame retardants, DECA is one of those. We also produce phosphorus-based flame retardants. We're number two in the world in phosphorus-based flame retardants. And we produce mineral-based flame retardants, aluminum trihydrate, magnesium hydroxide. So we number one in those. So we produce these alternatives, not to say that there's anything wrong with them, but they just not have not had the full extent of testing that DECA has. For the U.S. state activity, in 2003, California introduced a bill to prohibit the use of penta-octa and DECA. After review of many of the studies and information available on DECA, the bill was amended to remove the restriction on the use of DECA. The bill called the Senate Office of Research to review the available information on DECA and to recommend whether or not DECA should be addressed in future legislation. This report was published in May of 2004, and it recommended no action be taken against DECA, and such action would be unsupportable by science. There is no proposed bills in California that would restrict the use of DECA now or in the future. As for the other state activity, penta and octa and articles containing them have been banned or prohibited in four states. Again, California, Maine, Hawaii, and Michigan. DECA is not prohibited or restricted in any U.S. state or anywhere in North America. Proposed bills addressing PBDs have been introduced in various states, but none have passed. And with that, I would like to conclude by recommending that the committee vote against Senate Bill 962. And thank you very much. I'll turn it over to my colleague. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today in opposition to Senate Bill 962. I'd like to start by talking...
Identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Ray Dawson. I'm the chairman of the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum. We're an industry group devoted to developing science in support of our products, in support of the regulatory process, and are engaged on a global basis in discussions with regulators and legislators. I'd like to start by talking a little about the polybrominated diphenyl ether family. The family is made up of three commercial products. These are called penta, octa, and deca. It's important to recognize that these are quite distinct materials. For example, the penta material is a viscous liquid. It's actually made up of a complex mixture of different molecules. And the deca product is a white crystalline solid, 97% pure, fully brominated. very different physical characteristics are just one example in the way in which you need to look at these materials separately and consider each on its own merits. It really is not scientifically justified to treat these three members of the class as one. Each requires separate risk assessment in order to truly evaluate the risk and to measure and balance that risk against the benefit of the material. Probably the most complete risk assessment that has been completed on these products is that which has been carried out under the European Union. This is the most comprehensive assessment of the chemicals' environmental and human health impacts. The products have been assessed individually, not as a class. European risk assessment can lead to three conclusions. Conclusion one is that there is a need for further information to fill data gaps. Conclusion two is that there is at present no need for risk reduction measures beyond those that are currently being employed. And conclusion three is that there is a need for limiting the risks. Risk reduction measures that are already being applied shall be taken into account.
In the previous testimony, they had said that the European Union had banned DECA in July of 2006, I believe. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I will.
Or is that coming up?
It is coming up. Oh. Shall we leave it till later?
Yeah, leave it till later.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair. Let's look at the brominated flame retardants, the members of the PBDE family that have completed the European Union risk assessment. First of all, pentabromo diphenyl ether underwent risk assessment and as a result of that risk assessment was banned in Europe from August the 15th, 2004. Similarly, the octabromo diphenyl ether was also evaluated and also banned in Europe from August 2004. The manufacturer of the penta and octabrominated diphenyl ethers then took the decision to stop production in the United States. And so today, in practice, we have no further production of either the penta or the octa product. By contrast, if we look at decabromo diphenyl ether, we find that the conclusion of the risk assessment identified no risk, no need for risk reduction measures, and no restrictions on marketing. There were within the scope of the risk assessment a number of areas where it was felt judicious to generate more data, and the industry is cooperating with the regulators in Europe to develop that data in terms of monitoring environment, in terms of monitoring the presence of the material in blood and milk and the like, and in terms of carrying out some further testing. But the bottom line is the conclusion was that at this point in time, there is no justification to look for risk reduction measures on DECA.
Will you just clarify why all of this research is being done in Europe and not in the U.S., or is it some
of the testing is actually carried out in laboratories in the United States. The reason why I'm sharing this detail of European activity is because this is the most comprehensive risk assessment that has been carried out on any flame retardant. Again, it's a process which has been taken over 10 years. We have over 100 studies which have been involved. And I think it's important to recognize that we do know something about these materials. As I say, 10 years of evaluation, over 100 studies, detailed evaluation of the toxicology by different exposure routes to workers in different applications to the consumer, detailed evaluation of ecotoxicity in air, water, and terrestrial compartments. The risk assessment included evaluation of all the scientific data, the reports of DECA in the environment, the levels detected in breast milk, the potential for debromination or breakdown of the product. Again, I repeat, the bottom line, no identified need for risk reduction measures. There are other independent studies that have been completed on DECA, and they come to the same conclusions. The Voluntary Children's Chemical Exposure Program had a detailed study which evaluated the exposure of DECA to children. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences reviewed the use of DECA in textile applications in 2000 and again found that its use was acceptable and that, in fact, no further data was required. The Consumer Product Safety Commission at the same time agreed that DECA was suitable for use in that application. And the UK Department of Trade and Industry in the risks and benefits in the use of flame retardants concurred that the benefits of DECA far outweighed any potential risk. DECA is not persistent. It is persistent, but it is not bioaccumulative or toxic, so it cannot be classified as a PBT material. We recognize that persistence in many ways is not an ideal characteristic, but in some respects, in the application as a flame retardant, it is important that flame retardancy lasts the life of the product. And so to some extent, persistency is a requirement for the product to perform its job over the life of a product which may be 10 or 15 years. DECA BDE in the environment does not contribute significantly to environmental levels of penta. Anaerobic degradation studies indicate no significant degradation to lower BDEs. Studies show that in sunlight there is an insignificant contribution to penta levels, and analysis of sediments in Europe show that there is a trend of increasing DECA, whereas we see a fall in the level of penta or tetra. If there was a causal link between the two, we would expect them to move in step. In very simple terms, and this is rather a complex question, if you like, the fingerprint of the products of breakdown of DECA, when you run experiments in the laboratory to force degradation, do not match the fingerprints of what you find in the environment. The fingerprint of what we find in the environment is clearly associated with the penta product, the commercial product that is sold today.
Penta and octa?
Well, there is a part of octa. It's associated with, if you look in detail at the congeners that are found, for example, in breast milk, they tend to be the tetrabrominated, pentabrominated, and hexabrominated materials. Penta contains all of those. Octa contains some of the hexa, so to some extent octa also contributes to the loading of breast milk. Let's talk a little more about levels in breast milk. The concern, of course, is we're seeing increased levels of the components of commercial penta in breast milk. As I indicated, the tetra, the penta, the hexa. We believe that the cessation of manufacture of the penta and octa products addresses this concern. By contrast, the levels of DECA that are detected in breast milk are extremely low. They're in the parts per trillion range on a whole milk basis. And as I think I've shared with a number of people, to put some perspective behind this, if we talk about 10 parts per trillion, this is the equivalent of less than 10 seconds in 30,000 years. Move on to the EU ROS. This is the directive, Madam Chair, that you were referring to earlier, which is a directive limiting the use of certain materials in electrical equipment. And indeed, the directive limits the use of polybrominated diphenyl ethers in electronic equipment from July 2006. However, within the directive, there was a requirement that as a matter of priority, the European Commission would review the situation of DECA once the risk assessment of DECA was completed. And I can tell you that within the last few days, indeed on March the 21st of this year, the EU Commission has recommended that DECA should be exempted from the EU ROS directive. This recommendation is based on the results of the risk assessment and careful evaluation by independent experts. So to summarize our objections to Senate Bill 962, we believe that calling for a ban on DECA BDE is not justified by the science. We believe that potentially to ban DECA BDE risks reduced levels of fire safety for the citizens of Oregon. And finally, we are concerned that substitution of DECA BDE with less proven flame retardants is a recipe for potentially creating future problems. With that, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions at this point? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been involved in fires that inadvertently had plastic in them, and that stuff is absolutely toxic when it burns. Would you be supportive of the bill with the -1 amendments that delete reference to DECA from the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, could I answer that, please? Because I wanted to say this before we got off the stand anyway. I think that this industry has taken a very responsible position in this, and I think they've went to extraordinary measures to measure the levels of risk in DECA and these other products. I went to the proponents of this bill, Mr. Blevins in particular, the first week of the session, or perhaps the second week of the session, and suggested that we work together on a bill that didn't ban DECA and that banned these other two products, and that set out additional reporting by Department of Human Services or whatever. And these folks are pledged to work on a bill like that. And our problem is that the proponents of the bill refuse to talk about that. They want this bill the way it is. So we're left with no alternative but to oppose the bill.
Okay. We'll follow up, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to I want to thank the panel for the information. We get a lot of information, science based on laboratory experiments, and it's nice to see something that's based in real life for a change. It's refreshing. Thank you very much.
And we may be calling you back up, so if you will stay around.
Thank you.
All right. Now I would like to call Janie Huff, Jennifer Kimball. Those are the ones. We'll go two at a time, I guess. Well, I've got. Okay, so if you'll track that and let me know, I got. Okay.
Hi. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill. And I would like to express my special thanks to you, Senator Anderson, for sponsoring this legislation. My name is Jennifer Kimball, and I am the mother of Elliot here, who is 7 months old and woke up from his nap to be here. I'm here as a concerned mom. I'm worried about the chemicals in my body and in my breast milk, and what I may be exposing Elliot to. I've chosen to breastfeed because it is the healthiest choice for my baby. But these toxic flame retardants that are present in so many household products, it's nearly impossible for me to know what's safe and what isn't. I'm lucky if I get to brush my teeth some days, let alone read warning labels and research things like this. So, and children are on the floor constantly. They put everything into their mouth. Without knowing what's in everything, it's impossible, I feel, to keep them safe from something like this. And I have read that when exposure to toxic flame retardants is reduced, that levels in humans also decrease. So the best way to protect my child from these toxic flame retardants is to phase out the use of all these products of them in Oregon. So I'm just asking you to please support Senate Bill 962 and create a healthy environment for myself, Elliot, and all the babies in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Janie Huff Slangard. I am a pediatric nurse practitioner in Portland. Senator Monis Anderson, thank you for, and the members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to express my support for Senate Bill 962. I am a member of the Oregon Pediatric Nurse Practitioner Society. I'm also a member of the National Association for Pediatric Nurse Practitioners and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We are concerned about brominated flame retardants because research studies link these chemicals to serious health morbidities, including memory impairment, learning disabilities, and behavioral problems, even at low levels in humans, in laboratory animals. They've also been associated with the disruptions of the balance in the thyroid stimulating hormone, the incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of serious cancer in humans, and a variety of cancers in rodents.
Do you, in those studies, do you have them broken out?
I can give those to you.
Mm-hmm. And if it, I know the penta and the octa, and then the deca.
The deca, okay. Mm-hmm. Numerous studies show that the levels of these toxic flame retardants are rising rapidly in the people and the environment. There's no way for people to completely avoid them. This is a clear case where the chemicals need to be removed at the industry level and replaced by safer fire retardant materials. I'm here to speak to you about two reasons for my concerns as it relates to my field of expertise with children and with families. The tissue absorption rate of this little guy right here is increased because of the rapid growth of his body. The first year of life, a child grows more than any other time in your entire lifetime, including puberty. The lungs, skin, and the gastrointestinal tract are highly permeable. That results in the absorption of a disproportionate amount of environmental toxins. Newborns are at an even higher risk because of their immature organs, and they're slow to metabolize the substances in order to excrete and detoxify their body, where as adults we have a little bit more protection. Children consume more water, juice, milk, and fresh fruit per pound of body weight and are physically closer than adults, and they're thereby ingesting more pesticides and environmental toxins than adults. Children are outdoors more than adults. They breathe more pollutants per pound of body weight and are physically closer to the ground than adults, putting them at a higher rate of contact with their environment. Children's inquisitiveness in exploring nature means they put more objects in their mouth. Nothing escapes their mouth. They crawl and play on floors and in grass, which leads to increased exposure to environmental toxins and result in respiratory problems, lead poisoning, and pesticide poisonings. My second concern has to do with the absorption of environmental pollutants and toxins by mothers. As I mentioned before, newborns are at a higher risk of harm from toxins, and breastfeeding remains the best feeding option for newborns. From its inception, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners have been staunch advocates of breastfeeding as the optimal form of nutrition for children. Although economic, cultural, and political pressures often confound decisions about infant feeding, we firmly adhere to the position that breastfeeding ensures the best possible health as well as the developmental and psychosocial outcomes for an infant. Research studies use human milk to evaluate excretion of toxins and pollutants because these substances are stored in fat tissue, and the body utilizes the mother's fat to produce breast milk. While what we know now about these levels in human milk is not enough to recommend discontinuing breastfeeding, it is still a major concern about the length of exposure of children to environmental toxins and pollutants. I hope our government is sensitive to these issues, and I urge you to act in the best interest of the children in our state. Public health measures have proved to decrease the levels of toxic chemicals in our children and ourselves. Regulatory frameworks such as in Senate Bill 962 are important to ensure the decrease in levels and removal of contaminants in our environment. Removing these toxic flame retardants from manufacture and use and from our environment is essential to make Oregon a place where our children can learn, play, and grow without risk from exposure. With mounting scientific evidence of these chemicals' harmful effects, we both have the ability and the responsibility to take action now to protect public health. We urge you to take strong steps to protect the future generations of Oregonians.
Thank you. Discussion? Okay, Kim Hooper and Catherine Thompson.
I could run that if you'd like it in. Does that work? Or you go back one?
Give them to Ms. Kennison.
Go back one on that. Or? Yeah, there you go.
Is that forward? Which way is forward? This way? Okay.
Well, thank you.
Want to dim the lights a little bit?
In my understanding, I have about 8 minutes, so I'll go pretty rapidly. My name is Kim Hooper. I'm with the California Environmental Protection Agency, and I want to talk today about DECA and why we have some concerns. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay. I'm here as a private citizen, not as a representative of Cal EPA. There's an expression, genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. And what that means is that at conception, we're given our, when the egg meets the sperm, you're given your genetic complement. But what you become is not only that, but what you experience subsequent to that union. And that includes love, stress, and chemical exposures. And these exposures can happen in utero, right after conception, and continue through the infant's and children's development. This is my granddaughter, Karuna, and thinking about her, I'm 65, I was born in 1940, and my in utero exposures to chemicals are very different than hers are in 2004, because the chemical world hadn't really developed in 1940 nearly so much as it has now. The reasons we have concerns is the National Academy of Sciences estimates that 1 in 4 cases of developmental disabilities arises from chemical exposures. Learning disabilities have doubled in the last 20 years in California. Autism has soared to fourfold in the last 10 years. The PBDs, the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, you've heard, are added to many, many consumer products as a flame retardant, a good thing because it saves lives, but there are alternatives to that use. Concern is that it's present as an additive and not chemically bound to the matrix, either the foam or the plastic, and it's released into the environment, whether that's the DECA, the PENTA, the OCTA, no different. And you've known what they're used in, and there are the pictures of them. Here are the three commercial products used as additives, and you see the PENTA and the OCTA there at very small print. The PENTA is used in foam and the OCTA in plastic, and that print is proportional to actually the amounts that are used in commerce. And DECA, you see, is really the big gorilla in the closet. That's the one. You've regulated the two small ones. You haven't regulated the large one. And it may be partly because the large one is economically very viable. Three-fourths of the PBDs used are the DECA. It's used in plastics, majorly in computer and TV. You hear a lot of uses, but that's the major use, and in textiles and backing. Important is that fetal exposures occur with these chemicals. Placenta is no barrier for the PBDs, clearly for the lower brominateds. And as you'll hear, DECA breaks down to some of these lower brominateds, so they get through too. And it's also known that PBDs cause neurodevelopmental damage in test animals, test systems. Both the PENTA and the DECA have been shown to do that.
And what studies?
There's studies in mice by the same Swedish experimenters, in rats with an Italian study. With the DECA, there's one study.
It would be nice to have that.
We can give you that study. Yeah. There's no problem. The lower brominateds have increased exponentially in wildlife and people over the last 20 years. That's been well demonstrated. This is just one of the species. You can see the same things happening in breast milk. The PENTA and OCTA were banned because of this enormous reservoir above ground, about 200 million pounds in consumer products, worldwide contamination, environment, wildlife and people, widespread human exposures. These consumer products, as you've heard, everywhere. The high levels in the products, between 5% and 15%, it's reported in the literature. No one's clear what that really level is because we can't really get that information from industry. But they're not a pinch of salt in a pot of soup. They're like tomatoes in tomato soup. It's pretty good levels. Neurodevelopmental damage occurs, and there's steep increases in body burdens. When you look at the profile of DECA, it seems like it's sort of an equally bad actor. There's an enormous reservoir above ground. If you assume a half-life of consumer products of 10 years, you have 1 billion pounds above ground in the world. It's fragile, and this is not necessarily good because it breaks down rapidly in light to lower brominated compounds and to unknown products. And one of the lessons of PBDs is what you don't know about, you can't measure. The PBDs have been with us for 20 or 30 years. We only learned about them really in 1998, about 5 years ago, because we started measuring for them. If you don't measure them, you won't see them. And we don't know what these breakdown products are, so we can't estimate whether they're increasing or decreasing in people. There's worldwide contamination of DECA, environment, wildlife, and people. There's widespread human exposure to the same consumer products. The levels are even higher, 5 to 30% are reported. Neurodevelopmental damage and these toxic breakdown products, some of the banned PBDs are there.
Are you saying that DECA breaks down rapidly?
Yes. And I'll show you the data for that. DECA causes neurodevelopmental damage in mice, irreversible motor and behavioral effects that worsen with age. The same effects are caused by the penta. The banned PCBs cause the same effects in the same systems, and the banned PCBs cause similar effects in humans. We haven't seen the effects from PBDs because we haven't studied them and haven't studied them long enough, and we don't want to wait for that to happen. This is the evidence for DECA breakdown. This is a case of DECA and toluene, and the laboratory scientists put DECA and the lower brominated, the tetra, and toluene, put it on the window ledge in a glass jar. The sunlight came through the glass of the window, came through the glass of the jar, and you see that DECA, the blue line, is 70% is gone in 2 days. And the red line is the lower brominated, the tetra, and that's stable for 2 weeks. So it looks like what happens is these things break down to the lower brominated, something that's more stable to sunlight. They did the same thing, putting the DECA on sand and sediment, and put some of that on the roof of the laboratory. What they found is pretty much the same thing. In 3 days, 70% of the DECA was gone. So DECA breaks down.
Have they done then studies with DECA broken down as to the effects on mice or?
No, they have not. When the manufacturers say they've done exhaustive studies on these chemicals, I disagree. I'll show you right here. There's lab warnings for when you're trying to study DECA, it's very sensitive to sunlight, minimize exposure to UV light, no fluorescent lights, no sunlight in the laboratory. You need to put UV filters on your fluorescent lights and on your windows. If we're doing analysis of DECA here, we get a false negative. We wouldn't see it because it breaks down. You leave your DECA out in a jar under these fluorescent lights and sunlight is gone. Okay? So you see, you pretend, it seems like there's no DECA here, but it's here. Okay? You have to store your extracts in brown glass vials, otherwise it breaks down. So that's what we do now. We weren't doing this a year ago, we're doing it now. So photolytic debromination is well known in basic chemistry. When you asked about what's known about DECA, in 1973, Norris, who's a chemist at Dow Chemical Company, showed that DECA breaks down to the hexa and other lower brominated chemicals. So it's been well known for a long time that DECA breaks down, and I don't know why anyone hasn't done the experiment you just talked about. Why haven't you shown that the lower products and breakdown products are fed to mice and find out what they do to mice? It hasn't been done. DECA in 15 years ago, the same thing was shown, and it formed the polybrominated dibenzofurans, which, as you know, is part of the dioxin and furan family, and so that also raises concerns. When you do DECA analysis in the right way, which only started happening in the last 2 or 3 years, you find DECA everywhere, in air, remote areas, rivers, lakes, and sediments, sewage, sludge, food, wildlife, members of the European Parliament, which are human-like organisms, and in house and office dust. And we spend about 95% of our time indoors, and so the fact that DECA is about half of the PBDs in house dust or office dust is a real concern. It looks like the PBDEs, unlike the other environmental contaminants we talk about, the sort of persistent organic pollutants, the DDTs, the PCBs, etc., these things start indoors. And we may be the first species with real exposures, as opposed to other things. DDT is outdoors, PCBs is outdoors, and we get our exposure through food. These things, we may get a significant amount of our exposure through our homes, our offices, etc. It's about 1 to 2 parts per million in most of the house dust studies. It's about that. Now, the previous manufacturing claim a couple of years ago was DECA was like a rock. It does not break down. It doesn't get out of the material. Stable like PCB, is not degraded in the environment, not dispersing products of sediment, not taken up by wildlife or people, not metabolized, not toxic, no problem. The reality has emerged in the last 2 or 3 years of research. It does break down in the environment. It's dispersed everywhere. it's taken up by wildlife and people. It breaks down in the environment and wildlife into some of the banned PBDs, and it has this neurodevelopmental toxicity.
Why do you think, then, that the European Union just 2 days ago puts it not at a risk?
I'll get to that. I'll just finish this, and we can talk about that. I'm glad you asked that. That gives me more time, right?
Okay.
The DECA, this is an interesting study just done, and part of the answer is data are still emerging. This is a study that was released last week in California. This is a family of four in California. The father and the mother over on the left, those low levels, this is DECA. The five-year-old daughter is fourfold higher than the father, and the one-year-old son, the toddler, is tenfold higher. One hypothesis is that's how much time they spend on the floor and get in contact with house dust. This is granddaughter Karuna, and this is a typical toddler position, sitting on the floor, crawling around, getting into house dust from either the fabric backing on that couch or the fabric backing on the draperies or released from computers and TV consoles.
Madam,
yes,
so,
Senator Marston.
Would you go back to that?
Yeah, sure.
I see the similarity.
Well, thank you. I consider that a compliment. She's much better looking than I am. Or maybe it was the clothes. I don't know. So I think in summary, we have a billion pounds of this DECA BDE. It's breaking down now in our homes, churches, restaurants, offices, legislatures, cars, buses, trains. It's breaking down right now here. The UV lights, the fluorescent lights, the sunlight is breaking it down. It breaks down into some of the lower brominated PBDs and things, other things we don't know about. And basically, the PBDs of this kind easily get into kids. The DECA does not easily enter into people. And one of the comments that was made previously was that DECA has found it at parts per trillion in breast milk. Not true. We've looked at 100 breast milk samples in Washington, around the U.S., and in California. DECA averages about 500 parts per trillion, and it goes up to the highest we see is about 4,000 parts per trillion. So it's about 4 ppb. Low compared to the other PBDEs, but the realization is that DECA actually may not go into breast milk very well. Scientifically, we're thinking about that. We think it's bound to proteins in the blood, and so we're getting a falsely low reading of DECA body burdens by looking at PBDs, and we think that when you look at blood, we'll see higher. And that's all I have to say. So with regard to the legislature.
Why, since you're from California, correct, why then have they not banned DECA?
They took up DECA 2 years ago when they took up Penta, Octa, and DECA, and the science was not nearly developed as it is now to look review that. I suspect they're going to take it up. I am not allowed to talk to the legislators, and I know that the NGOs are interested in doing that, so I suspect it's going to happen. I don't know.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. Senator Morse.
Thank you. You also mentioned Washington. You're talking about the state of Washington.
Yes.
They banned
yes.
DECA?
I think their legislature is considering that. I think the NGOs can tell you that. I think that's under consideration.
Am I right? May I?
Yeah.
Okay. Do any other states ban DECA yet? Or is something that
I think Maine. I'm not sure. No. I really shouldn't venture in that. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maine has. Yeah.
It's to go into effect in 2008, and it basically says that it's banned as long as there's alternatives readily available, and I'll be addressing the alternatives.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Other questions, Brian? Sure. I think my Toshiba, which is free of PBDEs, is too high tech.
Oh. Is DECA in that? Is that what you're saying?
No, there is no PBDEs in Toshiba currently.
You know, one thing you might think about, what's happening in homes and offices and restaurants and the like, is that there's DECA released, and then as it hits sunlight, it's continuously being degraded to the lower brominated. Some of the things we know, some of the things we don't. And I think those are the way that DECA gets into people, not as DECA, but it's as its derivatives, its breakdown products.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, please identify yourself.
Yes. My name is Catherine Thomason. I'm a physician, internal medicine. I am the board president of Oregon Chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I've submitted four pieces of information for you that I think you'll find very interesting. The first is a letter from the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, part of the University of Massachusetts, that has looked more extensively at alternative products. There's also a table which I will show some of here, which shows some alternative products extensively to let people know kind of where PBDs are now and what alternatives are available and are currently being used. In addition, a letter from Dr. Duran, who is representing the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians in favor of this bill. And the editorial from today's Oregonian, which indicates that we should be in favor of this bill as well. I slipped this slide in here on the alternatives just to remake the point that this was a study that was done on rubber workers making, putting DECA BDE in rubber to coat, to create a product. When they actually measured levels of all the different PBDEs in their blood, and they used a control of other workers that did not have these similar levels at all, they found that the DECA, which is almost 100%, 95% pure DECA when it's used in industry, that in their bodies, only 32% of their elevated levels really had to do with DECA, indicating that it probably does break down in the body. Because they were elevated levels of both Octa and Nona, the 8 and 9 congeners. And these were significantly elevated over workers who were not directly exposed. You've had a lot of information on the toxicity, and again, once we realize that DECA breaks down into these other congeners, lower brominated ones, then we know it is as toxic. Primarily in low levels. These are the various activities that nerve cells have to go through to create a functional brain in the fetus. And as you can see, there are many other things in the body that affect that development. You can see in yellow PCBs and PDBEs that we know affect the actual neuronal structures of the brain. Now, let's say we have an average IQ of 100 on a public and a you and me level, or even your children and my children, their IQs aren't going to be significantly different if they drop 5 points. But when you take it across the public, you're increasing your rates of mentally retarded children, which use 1/4 of our education dollar, by increasing them by 3.4% or million.
And that's all PPB. Those studies are based with all PPBs.
Again, I think the EPA scientist, Dr. Birnbaum, who's worked on this most extensively nationally, said we have more information now on PBDEs than we did when we banned PCBs back in the 70s. And PCBs are chemically very similar to the PBDEs. And we unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately, don't have human studies because the levels are about 1/10 of what the animal studies show cause a neurologic effect. Although about 5% of, like, these workers and other studies that have looked for levels both in breast milk and other blood levels show that about 5% of people have much higher levels than the rest of the population. Either they don't break it down adequately, so at least 5% of our population are do have higher levels.
Now, just clarification.
Yes.
We're throwing away around a lot of PCB.
Right. This is the known information on PCBs.
I have a question here. DECA BDE, is it a part of a PCB?
No.
Thank you.
It's just chemically they look and act very similar in the body.
May I? Okay. The Oregonian article talks about PBDEs. Now, is DECA a PBDE?
Right. That's what the whole bill is about, is the polybrominated biphenyl ethers.
But talking about the larger, the other types, DECA is one of three that is addressed in this bill. And we have an amendment that would pull DECA out of the bill and the other two would be left in the bill. So we have three categories. And this article that I is talking about the PBDEs and not pinpointing DECA, from what I can...
Yes, and their opinion is that they should be banned, that all the PBDEs should be banned in commercial use.
Okay.
It doesn't make too much sense to ban the pent and octa because they've been withdrawn already.
Okay, may I follow through?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it mentions that California, Hawaii, New York, Michigan, and Maine all have restricted these chemicals, but not necessarily. I don't know what that means, restricted. Earlier you said they were only banned in Maine.
DECA is only banned in Maine.
Okay. I have a
letter. Penta and Octa are banned in the other states.
We'll
be
get
phased
that,
out.
We'll get that clarified. I think that it there is a letter in our packet, which I can't find, that states that Maine, they have not banned it. I think they've restricted it. Maine has restricted it.
If there's a chemical or something like that.
I think they've targeted to be phased out if there are commercially alternative alternatives in use or for use.
Okay, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you.
Sure,
we'll
I'm
clarify
sorry.
That later.
This is a statement I made earlier. The two specific studies, the one in adult mice at the level about 10 times what we currently have in our systems, or at least our children do, showed that it did cause irreversible changes in brain function of the mice that worsened with age in terms of its ability to work through a maze, its ability to learn new material, such as that. In neonatal mice, levels in the brain continued to increase. In mice exposed only once, possibly indicating an actual uptake of the chemical into the brain. And in another study, 10 to 65% of DECA was actually directly absorbed from the diet of lab rats. So we do know it is directly absorbed from the GI tract, DECA itself.
And that is a study...
One is in the toxicological science, and the other is... National Toxicology Program.
And it would be interesting to see what kind of blind studies they did, et cetera, with that. But
they do controls.
They are controlled studies, yeah.
What's interesting on the brain part is that one thought is that it looks like DECA is taken in, but over the next week, actually the chemical migrates to the brain. It seems like maybe not as the DECA, but as breakdown products. Because they use uniformly labeled DECA. So they don't identify the stuff in the brain, but when the radioactivity hits there at the right time, you get the effects. When it goes not at the right time, you don't get the effects.
Thank you. Time of neurologic development.
Right.
The effect on the thyroid, and we know that levels of low thyroid in our children's development, and we screen for all children for low thyroid at birth, but within in utero, the PBDE metabolites actually bind to the protein that is required to deliver thyroid hormone to the fetus. So you have functionally low levels of thyroid, which is absolutely essential for brain development. It also, in studies, has been shown to affect the same receptor as dioxin in terms of its endocrine dysfunction. It delays puberty in male rats, so it's anti-androgenic. And it's affects increasing estrogenic activity when it's used with tests that are done on the endocrine disruptor screening programs. And that can be in a couple of different chemical ways. This is more about this. So basically, my portion of the presentation was more to be on the alternatives and some of the obvious impetuses for providing alternatives have been the directive on the restriction of hazardous substances, the ROHS, which in my understanding, it's only the 20% non-electronic that this ruling has been affected by, and not the 80% of electronics that are still directed to be phased out by 2008. There's a new program for eco-labeling so that computers such as Toshiba can actually have an eco-label on them. Many, many companies, Apple, Intel, Panasonic, which is 80% of the electronics, not only computers, but VCRs, televisions, cell phones, etc. And actually, back in 1999, the World Health Organization stated that brominated flame retardant should not be used when suitable alternatives are present.
Are you aware of the release of information from the, and I forget which study, on March 21st that takes out DECA from that 2006 ban that just came out?
Well, my understanding is that it took it out for the non-electronics and that they're continuing to persist with phasing out the electronic use.
Thank you.
And, of course, it has been banned completely in Sweden and several other countries such as Norway, the DECA as well. There are different approaches to flame retardant use. One is to use products that create products that don't have as much heat, separating the heat-containing elements. Another is to use naturally flame-resistant materials, and the third is to use other chemicals that are halogen-free, meaning the chlorine, bromine, fluorine types of element. Oops, I keep doing that, sorry. There are numerous alternatives that meet this highest underwriter lab standard that is set by the National Electronics Manufacturing Association. And these are just some examples that are included in the table that you have in front of you. So the biggest use, again, is in electronics. So in the printed circuit boards of anything that requires a circuit board, the material is actually epoxy to which they add these things. Now, like I had said, the polyphenylene sulfide is actually a flame-resistant plastic, so it doesn't need any additives in it, and it doesn't release any chemicals into the environment. The NFR stands for where you don't need flame retardants. The NH are non-halogenated flame retardants. So there are a variety of reactive nitrogen and phosphorus constituents that work differently than the brominated flame retardants, as well as two other major products, the ammonium and the aluminum. Sony, Hitachi have all developed different products that are used and meet, again, the requirements of the United States for flame retardant levels.
Has much research been done on those yet?
Yes, I will get to those. Again, the plastics and the laminates that have to do with your chair plastics and airplanes, buses, and so on, as well as computers. Volvo as a company has removed all PBDEs in its products. Electronic housings, again, this polyphenylene sulfide and the same kinds of products. Socket switches, ceramics are obviously less flammable, as well as other self-extinguishing plastics. These are, again, just a list of different types that you have in front of you. In furnitures and textiles, according to the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production in here, there are actually even more opportunities for alternatives. That has to do with different coatings. Serta has mattresses that use a fire barrier technology and therefore don't need any additional chemical flame retardants. IKEA has phased out the brominated flame retardants and is working to be free of all halogenated chemicals, and so on. These are some of the other ones in terms of what we know about them. I don't have the specific studies, but they have been well documented in the literature. That red phosphorus is not as useful in plastics. It's more useful in textiles and furniture and carpeting. As we go down the list, a number of them do not have any impact in humans, low impact on fish and wildlife, such as the aluminum trihydroxide, which actually is the most commonly used flame retardant in the world. Ammonium polyphosphate, again, comes recommended for its low toxicity. The magnesium hydroxide does not have adequate human studies, however, given its components, and again, there's always a difficulty in actually getting the actual chemical from the companies to study it, but it's chemically biodegradable and non-accumulative. Melamine as well, which is used more in textiles, and the antimony trioxide is an example of a bad, a bad player that we don't want people to turn to, but the bill obviously doesn't address that. But there certainly are other flame retardants that are chemicals that probably have some negative health consequences. Just two examples. Intel does not use PBDEs in its products at all. Hewlett-Packard, its monitoring housings now contain the phosphorus-based flame retardants, and they're working on their circuit board. And a huge list, as you can see on the bottom of that chart, of all the different companies that are actually just phasing out all the PBDs, including the DECA, because they see the writing on the wall. So our actions here help give them impetus to continue in this very important step to make us all healthier. Questions?
Great. We have 2 minutes left, but I'm going to take another 15. But at 2:30, we have to hear the next two bills. And so I will like to call up Myrna Soul, Amelia Simoth, and Rhett. What's the last name?
Oh, Lawrence.
Oh, Lawrence.
Show that to the chair, please. Just show it to him.
While they're coming up.
Don't. Just show it.
Okay, let me mark it.
You know, there's some conflicting testimony going on. Is that the same thing? She's
right. As people are coming up, I would like to clarify this main thing. Here's a letter from Senator John Martin from the Maine State Legislature, and it does say that I understand that there are some reports that Maine has banned DECA. This is not accurate. I would like to clarify that DECA remains an acceptable fire retardant for use in the state of Maine. That was dated June 15, 2004, from the Senate of Maine. Senator John Martin. Okay.
That would be from the Maine Senate, then, wouldn't it?
The Maine Senate. Oh, that's a little bit late. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Diane Drum. I am a public health nurse in maternal child health and a volunteer for the Health Policy Cabinet of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm a mother of three. I just did want to bring you this article, Senator Mona Sanderson. It's neurobehavioral derangements in adult mice receiving decabrominated diphenyl ether during the defined period of neonatal brain growth. I've read all these reports that have been presented to us by the American Chemistry Society. Thank you so much for hearing me. I know time is tight. I know how hard I've worked on this and how hard it is to be from my family. So I appreciate everyone who's here today. Briefly, I promise you briefly, as a public health nurse, I want to take a minute to look at some maternal child public health history, because it is not true that history repeats itself. History does not repeat itself, but it rhymes. Okay, so let's look at lead. 2,000 years ago, we knew lead was toxic. In 1925, an international covenant banned its use in indoor paint. However, the trade lobbies in the United States prevented that from happening. Their research showed that low levels of lead were safe. The Dutch boy was a direct public relations response to concerns about lead, and he carried around buckets labeled white lead. As a result, indoor paint, lead was not banned until 1977. It was not banned from gasoline until 1990. Today, years after the ban, 1 in 20 U.S. children is suffering the effects of low levels of lead. And while individually they may look fine, statistically and as a group, they are more prone to attention deficit disorder, decreased language skills, increased aggression, and delinquency. Another historical situation was mercury. In 1959, in the spring, there were 50 cases called Minamata disease. They did not know why this neurological disease was happening, but by that fall, studies had shown that there was a problem with heavy metal in the bay. The company said, that's methylmercury. What we dump is metallic mercury. It was not until 1962 that specific evidence showed how metallic mercury was converted to methyl mercury in the environment. By that time, 29% of the infants born around the bay and in the rivers that had subsequently been contaminated had neurological disabilities, and women with levels of mercury over 50 parts per million were strongly encouraged to get abortions. You asked earlier why the research from Europe. Europe, the European Common Union, is taking on a very ambitious program to look at chemicals currently in use and to apply the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle is something in international trade talks. If that's brought up, the United States delegation leaves the room. They have been under tremendous political and economic pressure to make some of the decisions they have made, and our tax dollars have actually gone to that lobbying effort in Europe. And I have more information on that for you if you'd like. Now we look back at lead and mercury and we say, well, that was so clear. That was so obvious. This is different. This is specifically, we're talking about DECA. And we've got good studies to show that it's okay. But I want to tell you that in those other situations, there were so-called good studies that showed it was okay. There are some things that are very clear. We know that 1 in 6 of our children is learning disabled. We know that autism is increasing, and we do not know why. We know that, according to an article I read from the American Chemical Society, that PBDEs are not bonded into the materials they supposedly protect. They are only dissolved. And as they are volatile and tend to bleed, their words, flame retardant decreases over time and environmental contamination increases. The European Joint Research Center that has been quoted, I quote something from them. It says, there is currently no evidence that significant degradation to lower brominated diphenyl ether congeners is actually occurring in the environment. Since some of the products may be more bioaccumulative and toxic than the parent compound, any significant formation would be a cause for concern. You have also seen numerous studies that show that DECA is breaking down in the environment, is breaking down in our bodies, and I would just like you to think, when you look at all these different conflicting studies, I would like you to think Minamata. Lab mammals who are exposed to levels only 10 times higher than the milk of Oregon women, their breast milk, showed permanent neurological damage when they were exposed during a period of rapid brain growth. That's some of the stuff that Catherine had up there. Now, we are finding that the American Chemical Society, the last time I heard them speak, are still saying that the dose makes the poison. But we are finding that there is a U-shaped curve, that very small doses at a specific period of time can cause an initial response. Later, when that development isn't happening, there may be no response at higher doses until another level of toxicity has reached. And I think it's that range of exposure at non-critical times that is responsible for some of the conflicting information that you're hearing today. As another point I would like to make, and I'll just make this very brief, human breast milk is irreplaceable. As a public health nurse, I know that poverty and its sequela cause huge influences on human development. And I appreciate that it's you and not me who's going to listen to all this different research and decide on a course that helps Oregon both economically and environmentally. But as you make the decisions about how are we going to monitor DECAs, how are we going to phase out DECAs, are DECAs really necessary, or are there alternatives, and can we mandate that we use those alternatives, I want you to remember that the past, and remember the suffering, the true suffering that's existing today and continuing into the future based on public health policy decisions we've made in the past. I said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, and I just wanted to spark up this hearing a little bit. So it will take tremendous political will to create a new verse. Here we are together in mid-stanza. What values will we bring to our rhyme? Will we risk our infants yet again, or will we protect them this time? Thank you.
Go ahead, Rhett.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm an environmental advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And just wanted to come before you today to urge this committee to support Senate Bill 962. I've submitted my written testimony there along with testimony from a few other organizations as well. And much of it overlaps with things that have been said already today, so I won't go through all of that. You've heard that PBDs are nearly ubiquitous in the environment now, turning up in humans and our breast milk and in Columbia River salmon and in orcas and Puget Sound. So the stuff is everywhere. I did want to address a couple of points that had been made earlier, and one goes to this issue of the fire safety and the flammability standards, and I just wanted to reiterate that this bill will in no way change any of the fire safety or flammability standards, and you know, any alternatives that would be used in place of the PBDs would have to meet those same standards. So it's we are not advocating that any fire safety standards be compromised. And one other point is that we've talked some about this EU risk assessment. I wanted to make the point that as I understand it, the EU ban on DECA is still in place, and it is slated to happen in 2006. There is this the risk assessment that came out in the last couple of days, and I believe they are, they've opened the conversation to, whether that is appropriate. But as it stands now, that ban is still in place for DECA as of 2006, as I understand it. So I just wanted to clarify that point. So essentially the bottom line here is that, you've heard about the science on DECA. We know that that these PBDs are unsafe, and that DECA, we are increasingly finding, is unsafe as well. And they're turning up in our bodies and our breast milk. They're not necessary. And so as we did with PCBs, when we had a lot less information about them, now we see the danger that these chemicals are posing to us, and we need to be proactive here, observe the precautionary principle, and make sure that we're banning these things before we start seeing them really cause health problems, even though, we're seeing that to some extent already. So, just would urge this committee to vote yes on Senate Bill 962 and to make sure that we're taking every step we can to get this get these hazardous chemicals out of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just would like to just say one thing that hasn't been brought up. We wonder how can we do something more advanced than the other states? The other states haven't done DECA. How can we? We have more recent information, number one. Number two, Americans have the highest levels of PBDE in our breast milk in the world. Oregonians have the highest level of PBDE in our breast milk in America.
Thank you. We have 4 minutes, and it looks like we won't get to our panel, but there are some questions I will want to ask, and I will do that by letter or orally after this. Myrna Sol, Catherine West, and Amelia, is it White?
Wyatt, yeah.
Oh, Wyatt, and Amelia.
I might have left.
Okay.
I'm getting mixed messy.
Go ahead.
You have some things also there from the Developmental Disabilities Coalition that lady had to leave, and also from the Family Action.
Please Coalition. Identify yourself.
Yes. I am Myrna Sol. I am the director of Woodmont School for Dyslexics. I deal with learning disabled children all day long for the last 40 years. I'm also here as the president of the Learning Disability Association of Oregon. And I want to thank you, Chair, for letting us come and talk, and the rest of the members. I'm here to support the bill, SB 962, and urge you to phase out the use of toxic flame retardants in Oregon. First, I want to commend you for taking up this issue. The LDA of Oregon is most concerned about the potential toxic exposures that can put developing fetuses, and infants and young children at risk. Children are particularly vulnerable to the dangers of toxic chemicals because their biological systems, including their nervous systems and brains, are still developing. We are concerned about certain brominated flame retardants because laboratory research suggests they can harm the developing brain and neurological systems in growing infants and can cause neurotoxic effects similar to banned PCBs. The Learning Disability Association of Oregon is part of a national effort linked with the American Association of Mental Retardation and the Autism Society, which we have many, many cases in Oregon of autism, to help raise healthier children, kids. All of our groups are observing increasing numbers of children with learning and developmental disabilities. Over my 40-year span of teaching, it has really increased, and the severity has increased. This increase also causes significant emotional and social costs to these children.
We have a minute left, so could you sum up?
And their families and communities. We also see the increasing economic costs associated with low-cost special education and lower intellectual capacity. Also, the school dropout and incarceration, if we say it affects 20% of our population, it's just the opposite in juvenile hall. The cornerstone of public health is prevention, and that's what I would like you to think about for today. We have shown in the past that we have the willingness to create a healthier environment for our children by reducing lead and tobacco exposures. We have another opportunity to do the right thing now. I urge you to phase out all of the PBDEs. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Amelia Pismine. I'm the Executive Director of Nursing Mothers Council of Oregon. We're a breastfeeding peer counseling organization. My board felt that it was beyond our mission to take a position on this bill, but that it was important to come and speak and give a footnote to many of the other people who have given testimony to just say breast milk is by far the optimal source of infant nutrition, and that by far the risks of not breastfeeding outweigh the risks of breastfeeding in a polluted world. Babies who are not exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months of life are at increased risk for severe respiratory illness, recurrent ear infections, severe diarrhea, obesity, and all the health causes concerns related to that, type 1 diabetes, certain childhood cancers, and infant mortality. Lack of breastfeeding by mothers increases their risk to breast and cervical cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, and retention of pregnancy weight gain. And we'll just cap off, since we need to be brief, by saying that whether by umbilical cord or by breast, the human infant feeds at the top of the food chain. So the choices that we make here affect them the most of all. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The last person we do have is Gail Shibley. Gail, do you have any specific research-oriented okay, can you do it in 30 seconds?
Mm-hmm. You used to be a legislator. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems. And I won't try to repeat any of the epidemiological or toxicological issues that have been raised already. My office deals with, among many other things, within public health, protecting our children from contaminated drug labs, from lead-based paint, and thanks to an enormous champion on your committee for emergency medical services for kids. We, in concept, support further research and analysis regarding the risk of harm to the public from substances like PBDEs. We do recognize that there is an expected fiscal impact to the department that is not contained in the governor's recommended budget. Trying to slim that down as much as possible, it remains about $35,000 biennium at 0.25 of an FTE, and I just wanted to make sure the committee had that information as part of your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Shibley. Discussion? Any final comments? Yeah, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to say that we should, whenever we proceed in areas like this, it should be done with caution. And I hearken back to a book many, many, many years ago by a woman by the name of Rachel Green called Silent Spring, and which was based on some somewhat dubious science. The result of that book was that there was a groundswell in the nation, and we banned DDT. looking back, DDT was a rather benign substance, but the ultimate result of that is that we now have 30,000 deaths worldwide due to malaria because we cannot combat the mosquito. So there are consequences to actions. We banned Freon because we thought it was having a tremendous impact on the ozone layer, and it was replaced at the cost of billions of dollars by industry by another chemical which is actually more toxic. So we need to make sure that we are doing this based on good science. I've always had issues with scientific research that bombards mice and calls that humans. So we just need to proceed with caution, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And what I will do, there are just some clarifications that I need to make with the people that testified. I'll be contacting you, and then I'll be talking individually with each member of the committee to see where we will progress from here. So with that, I will close a public hearing on 962, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 783 and Senate Bill 784 together.
Senator?
I want to go. Okay.
Explain.
Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Bacobian.
Thank you, Sarah. And just for brevity, I will not walk through it, but in front of you is a hand-engrossed version of Senate Bill 783 with the -1 amendments. These were friendly amendments from Senator Morissette's office, so I engrossed them into the bill. And so for the sake of this hearing, we'll be treating the amended version as the actual bill. And I'll defer to the senator and the testifiers to kind of walk through later about what the bill actually does. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I move this microphone to
yes.
Please do not move microphone. I've never seen it before.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Morissette, Senator from District 6, parts of Lane and Linn County. Thank you very much for hearing these two bills. I know, well, we're not going to have a work session, but I do appreciate the opportunity. This is the third session that I've worked on this. And there have been problems in the past that we have had to resolve with the Nurses Association, and we had a meeting in Eugene 2 weeks ago. People traveled from Portland to attend that meeting to work out a compromise with the Nurses Association, which we have done. The Hospital Association has not ever been involved in a discussion, but my first comments to the proponents of the bill was that why would the hospitals like a bill that added another bargaining unit or possibly recognizing people who are not recognized now, because you know they can bring someone in off the street and have them function as a technician without training or without certification. This bill is about certification. This bill is a patient safety bill. It's to make sure that the people who are working in the operating room are recognized as professionals that meet standards. To me, it's a no-brainer. But you have to overcome all of the turf battles and all of the economic objections that the hospital will probably raise. It's going to cost us more money to recognize this class of people because we may have to pay them more. So I feel very frustrated, and I hope that finally this year we can move things along. Now, I did talk to the director of the Department of Human Services, who graciously said, yes, we can work with you on this bill to certify, not license, but certify technicians. You may hear some contradiction to that, but when Mr. Weeks is back in town, I will invite him to my office one more time, and we will get that in writing. But today I would like to have Deborah Turner, the major proponent of the bill, an opportunity to speak. And she's been here before when she supported the circulating nurse. She's gone out of her way to support nursing requests and to differentiate duties and recognize professionals in categories where they haven't been particularly recognized. This is always a goal, I think, is that you have to delineate responsibilities and recognize the people who fit into those categories, and that's exactly what we're trying to do today. So, thank you.
Don't move the microphone.
Thank you.
Senator Monis Anderson and committee. My name is Deborah Turner. I'm a certified surgical technologist, certified first assistant. I work as a surgical assistant for a group of orthopedic surgeons. I am the chairperson of the Government and Public Affairs Committee for the Oregon State Assembly of the Association of Surgical Technologists. The surgical technologist and the surgical assistant are the only professionals that work in the operating room who are not regulated. So I am here today in support of Senate Bill 784. The successful surgical procedures require a group effort. It involves a team of competent, caring professionals and a great deal of teamwork in the operating room. With their mask on, the team members all look the same. They do, of course, have different responsibilities. You have the surgeon, anesthesiologist, nurse, anesthetist, registered nurse, who are all licensed. But the profession still, like I said, of surgical technology and surgical assisting is the remaining profession to be regulated. We now bring it before you, our legislators of the state of Oregon, to make sure that our general public is protected by the minimum requirements set forth by our profession. The state of Oregon would not hire a nurse or a doctor to practice in this state without a license. The same should hold true for the surgical technologist and the surgical assistant. The surgical technologists are the only professionals specifically educated to work in the operative environment with over 400 educational programs, which are currently accredited through a formal accreditation process involving the American College of Surgeons, American Hospitals Association, and the Association of Surgical Technologists. These schools graduate over 5,000 students per year with the skills to work as a surgical technologist. So we feel that there is no need to hire someone with lesser training for this position. Certification is how we demonstrate our expertise in surgical technology to our employers, the healthcare community, and the public. Surgical technologists have a system of educational standards developed over 30 years ago. We feel that merely training someone for a few short weeks or months poses a threat to the patient, and that the only individuals qualified to serve in the scrub role are properly trained. These surgical technologists in the role should be graduates of a CAHAP-accredited school of surgical technology. In Oregon, we have two surgical technology programs, one at Mount Hood, which is an associate's degree, and one in Southwestern Community College in Coos Bay, which is a certificate. There's a new program that has just recently started up. It's Concord College in Portland, and they are working on their accreditation. The Oregon State Assembly of the Association of Surgical Technologists supports state mandatory certification of surgical technologists in order to protect the public. This would be accomplished by utilizing the established national certification to allow only those practitioners who have proven their level of competency to be regulated with the state under the Department of Human Services. This would ensure the public's safety at a low cost of administering, with the costs financed by the practitioner. Regulation would safeguard the patient by utilizing only those CSTs who have been properly educated and trained and who has met a recognized competency level by taking and passing the national certification exam. We had a grandfather clause written in this bill, but we have been told that it would be best to leave that to rules writing. We are concerned about the effects that this would have on some people in this state, and we do not want anyone to lose their job. So we would look for a grandfather rules to be in this bill. The surgical technologist must have the ability to integrate an understanding of anatomy and physiology with prescribed surgical procedure and be able to anticipate the sequence of events and needs of the surgeon. The individual must possess excellent manual dexterity and react quickly to convey and receive instruments from the surgeon. The surgical technologist must be able to communicate effectively and to function efficiently and calmly in extremely stressful environments. Careful attention to detail is required to ensure maintenance of a sterile field and observance of accepted procedures designed to protect the patient. I want to thank you for your time today and for listening. I have been in the field of surgical technology for 29 years, 17 of those in the state of Oregon. We have pride and passion for what we do, and we feel that regulation of the surgical technologist is in our patient's best interest. We are doing this for the right reasons, quality patient care for the patients in the state of Oregon, not for more recognition, not for more pay. Safety of our patients should be on everyone's agenda, and mandating regulation will help safeguard this for everyone. Thank you.
Were you the one that cared for Senator Morissette?
I am.
He has only the most wonderful things to say about you as a surgical tech.
You saved my life.
And he wants to do things to help you.
Madam Chair, I just have to say that I put an X on the hip that they were going to operate on, so they wouldn't do it on the other hip. And I think she handed me the marker to do that.
So. My question, Madam Chair, would be: as if he was asleep during the surgery, how would he actually know what she was doing?
But that was when I opened my eyes in the gurney. There she was, coming into the operating
room. Oh.
Front end care. Madam Chair, members of the Health Policy Committee, distinguished others, thank you very much for letting me come and speak today. My name is Adam B. Perriam, and I am a certified surgical technologist and a certified nursing assistant also through the Oregon State Board of Nursing. And I am the current president of the Oregon State Assembly of the Association of Surgical Technologists, and I drove down here from Portland to have the opportunity to speak today. And thank you for my opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bills 783 and 784. In congruent to this appreciation, I'll try to be brief. I consider coming here today to go on about who I am and how I started as a surgical technologist and what drove me to apply for schooling at the Coos Bay program back in 2000. I thought I could tell you about my personal matters, like the joy I see from seeing my fiance smiling at me and the loss of my father and grandmother that affected me in 94 after caring them for them, myself and my mother, for 8 years down in rural Oregon in Coos Bay. Or I could tell you harrowing details of surgical procedures that I've been in, especially at OHSU where I work currently, like traumas that would make good ER, good scripts for an ER show. But my last 12 years as an Oregon State Board of Nursing certified nurse's aide, and my last 2 years as an LCC certified surgical technologist are just a couple of my credentials. However, these details are my experiences, and because they don't apply to others, it's not what matters today. What I did come to speak today for is the same reason that I do what I do every day for 36 hours a week, and that's because every surgical patient could be my mother, could be my wife-to-be, could be my best friend, and I treat them as precious, and because they are surely someone else's friend or family member. I show this compassion by being methodical in my job. I have been trained to be that way, and I would hope everyone, including their loved ones who are facing surgery or not otherwise, to not just assume but demand that same methodical care from every single qualified member of a trained surgical team. This is not the case, though, as currently untrained, non-educated individuals perform the surgical scrub, they don the surgical gowns and gloves, and they assist in a host of surgeries across the state of Oregon with as few as days of training, where they have been only present for as many as maybe a hand count or less of surgeries before being allowed to scrub unaided. Such an employee could be present at the delivery of my child by cesarean section. They could be the person passing off the very suture that would be needed to tie off my own bleeding aorta from a car crash. They could be also for assisting with the insertion of a fiber optic endoscope and cable for a routine check of my mother's colon or for cancer, routine checks. They possess just a passive, hastened knowledge of instrumentation. Without learning the proper handling or maintenance of that instrumentation. They are not required to maintain levels of education that could benefit them in learning more about the workings of a human body, let alone improve the abilities of the surgical field. Yet these workers stand over an open cavity, exposed to the microbe-filled air for the first time, and they also hand scalpels, retractors, scissors, and just like I do. As a surgical technologist, I do more than just hand instruments to the surgeon. I anticipate by seeing what is before me at the surgical field. I comprehend when to request extra equipment and materials to be opened by a registered nurse because I cannot, at that time, open them myself when I'm scrubbed in. I maintain my education through national conferences, state-run workshops, online video feeds, magazine articles of my own choosing, and by standards established by the national organization through whom I am certified, and by standards, and that is also why I became involved in the Oregon State Assembly, with the hopes of teaching what I've learned, and become the president of it, with the opportunity to meet with those students in Oregon surgical technology programs. These are just some of the benefits that becoming certified and educated have offered me, and I would gladly offer these benefits to those without certification if they would so choose it. Today, I work aside physicians, residents, and nurses who are recognized as the professionals that they are. However, I am regarded, despite my education, my hard work, and my dedication, as a subordinate, filling a role often overlooked while the surgeon performs his skill because a non-educated, improperly trained, and uncertified individuals are allowed to be hired in the same job that I do. I support these two bills for four specific reasons. First, the bills will recognize the surgical technologists and surgical assistants in the state of Oregon as professionals who have committed to and educated themselves in the meticulous environment of surgical care. Second, they will require those individuals wishing to work in this area of expertise to have completed more than just a basic training in what the instruments are used and when, or an expedited orientation period to fill an open position with just a loosely qualified applicant. Third, they do not require those working in the field of surgical technology, I would hope, and assistants to be formally educated in their current employment, only state certified, thereby preventing the loss of jobs for hard workers and prevents further untrained workers from entering the surgical environment, yet encouraging those employed to maintain their educational level. Fourthly and lastly, these bills will establish standards which facilitates wishing to hire surgical technologists and surgical first assistants will be held to follow and assist in screening such qualified individuals. In short, these bills establishes that the state of Oregon hires people who assist in this area of surgery, an invasive opening of a living human body and its subsequent return to a nearly perfect sterile state, that they are qualified and educated in this field, and we hold that they are the same things that we hold to those in the state of Oregon that cut hair, that pierce or tattoo other individuals, that sell and serve alcohol, handle food products, teach in schools, and a litany of other professions that will not hire without a current certification in their field. Members of Oregon's Health Policy Committee, I am from Coos Bay, Oregon. I am a soon-to-be husband. I am a full-time Portland State University student, and I am president of this state assembly of nearly 120 members, and I am a certified surgical technologist. I hope with the passage of these bills, myself and those that work in this field are recognized as more than just workers filling a role, and definitely this more than just filling an occupation, but that we are regarded as certified professionals in surgery in the state of Oregon. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Do I give testimony on 783 at this time also?
Well, we need to...
I can make it short.
Okay, make it short.
Okay. The Oregon State Assembly of the Association of Surgical Technologists recognizes that surgical assistants must have skills necessary to perform complex tasks that require more advanced specialized education and training, and supports mandatory certification of this individual in order to protect the public. The field of surgical assisting is undergoing some of the biggest changes in the history of the profession. These changes will have a dramatic effect on our career. With growing public interest in health care insurance and the qualifications of the individual who care for patients, there has been an increased call for regulation of all individuals who provide direct patient care, and the operating room is certainly no exception. Certification as a surgical assistant provides evidence to employers, other healthcare professionals, and the public that the certified individual has met the national standard for the knowledge that underlies surgical assistant practice. Certified individuals demonstrate mastery of a broad range of knowledge of surgical procedures, aseptic technique, and patient care by successfully completing and certifying their certification examinations. Our goal is to provide safe, quality care for surgical patients. To achieve the goal, we feel that regulation of this profession should be mandatory. Regulation would allow the state of Oregon to begin to provide the public a level of protection that they are not able to provide themselves through the education and certification standards similar to the other professionals in the operating room, and to impose the high standards already agreed upon by our profession to protect the public. Regulation would safeguard the patient by utilizing only surgical assistants who have been properly educated and trained to assist the surgeon and who have met a recognized competency level by taking and passing the national certification exam. Now, as defined by the American College of Surgeons, the first assistant provides aid in exposure, hemostasis, and other technical functions that will help the surgeon carry out a safe operation with optimal results for the patient. The role may vary considerably with the surgical operation, specialty area, and type of facility. The people in Oregon trust that each individual in our operating rooms have been through appropriate training in their field of expertise. The opportunity is there now for our legislatures of our state to ensure quality, safe patient care for everyone. Help us make this a reality with regulation of this profession. I do have a list of regulation that is going on in the United States if you would like to hear. The first will be the PAST regulation. In Tennessee, they regulated surgical technologists last year. They have mandatory certification. Kentucky, they have surgical assistant certification and surgical assistant reimbursement. Illinois, surgical technologist registration and title protection in 2003. Surgical assistant registration and title protection 2003. Surgical assistant reimbursement 2003. Texas, surgical assistant licensure 2001.
We need to get out, so could you just list the states? That would be good.
Yes, Washington, and then there's Kentucky, Missouri, Florida, Georgia, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and South Carolina. Adam, our president, mentioned that we had 120 members in the state. We have called each and every hospital in this state to get an accurate count of surgical technologists and surgical assistants in the state. We're right at 450 for surgical technologists and 50 for surgical assistants. Thank you.
Thank you.
A lot of work to get.
All right. We will continue this at another time. I so wanted to get you in, and there's a number of others but our administrator has asked them to come back when we have it rescheduled. All right. Thank you very much. I'd like to close the public hearing on 783 and close the public hearing on 784, and the meeting is adjourned.